I'm Chuck Smeaton from the Royal Institution of Australia, and this is the Cosmos Briefing Podcast. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land wherever you are listening from today, and I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present. Today we are joined by Elizabeth Finkel, a multi-award-winning science journalist, author, biochemist, and the co-founder of Cosmos Magazine. She's recently written a letter and a series of articles on cosmosmagazine.com that delve deep into the science behind COVID-19 vaccines, speaking specifically to people who are hesitant about getting a jab. It's a true COVID toolkit, and it's fascinating to hear her talk through the challenges she faced in explaining the science. Today's interview is hosted by Cosmos journalist Lauren Fuge.
Ella, what motivated you to write this letter? Did you have someone in mind that you were writing to?
Absolutely. So a friend of mine, whose name I will not mention, and a science lover and avid fan of Cosmos, and a few years older than me, and I was alarmed to discover that he had not been vaccinated. So this is going back about 5 weeks now. And because he is generally a rational person, you know, very scientific in his thinking, I thought, okay, well, let me try and address his concerns. So, you know, over a period of about 4 weeks, he emailed me his concerns, and then I went away and burrowed into the literature and then increasingly found myself needing to interview people to try to get deeper answers to his questions. Mm-hmm. And at the end of about 4 or 5 weeks, I thought, as it happens, I didn't convince him. But I thought, hell, I've got all this information I've dug up. I'm going to use it for something. Mm-hmm. And so I've used it for the series of articles. Mm-hmm. I did have two other successes, though, because I had two other friends at the same time who I discovered were anxious about getting vaccinated, and they did get vaccinated. And I think I played at least some part in addressing their concerns.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that process of going and chasing down the facts. Like, who did you speak to? How did you get in touch with them? And was it difficult to actually understand the data?
Yes. So one of the concerns my friend had was, well, there were two things. He made the point, and this is probably going about 5 weeks ago when we weren't really in the full grip of Delta as we are now, and he was saying, look, you know, on what basis do they come up with the mortality statistics for COVID? And on the other hand, on what basis do they come up with statistics for vaccine safety? So in other words, as he was trying to weigh these things up in his mind, benefit versus risk analysis, he was dubious both about the death rate from COVID and the adverse effects rate from the vaccines. And I thought, okay, I'll go away and try to dig that up. Now, the first one is kind of tricky. How do you report the death rate from COVID? Because when a person dies from COVID, they may have died having been infected from COVID, but was it COVID that really killed them? Maybe, you know, they'd had a heart attack, or, you know, they had cancer or some other underlying condition. So in his mind, were the statistics of death inflated? So it was difficult to figure that one out, because people have modified the way they report death rates in the course of the pandemic. So at the beginning, you know, they had quite a wide interval of time after a person had been infected when they would say yes, that we would count that as a death from COVID. But as time went along, they tightened that up so that, you know, I can't remember exactly what the figure was, but they tightened it up. And so it's not a straightforward question to answer. Different jurisdictions do it in different ways. And I think right now it's become a moot point because, you know, and even then, really, frankly, it was a moot point. All you had to do was to turn on your TV and see the, you know, the expanse, this ocean of newly dug graves in Brazil or Italy or anywhere. Now, how could anybody doubt that something new and serious was causing that Holocaust? And to say, oh, no, there's nothing going on here, nothing to see. Well, that's kind of absurd, really. So really seeing those seas of graveyards, you know, it's really kind of a moot point. But to address his point, technically, yes, different jurisdictions count deaths from COVID in different ways. But I don't think anyone in Australia at this moment can doubt what is going on in Sydney, you know, hundreds of people dying from the Delta pandemic there. And the Sydney death rate at the moment is 1% overall. If you are infected with COVID, your chance of dying from COVID is 1%, and higher at higher age groups, lower at younger age groups. I spent more time on his second question, which was, when you've got this database of adverse effects, which people make a big deal about everywhere, in America, in the UK, these databases are completely transparent because people are very vigilant about new vaccines. We know that no new vaccine is a walk in the park. We have to be very, very vigilant. We do the first round of safety trials, phase 1, 2, and 3, like we've always done for every drug, for every vaccine. But even though those were done on, in the case of Astra, 30,000 people, in the case of Pfizer on 40,000 people, you still know that when you roll it out into mass vaccination into a general population, you have to be incredibly vigilant. And the databases all over the world are very transparent. So they throw everything in there. And so you can look at, for instance, our database of adverse effects notifications, DAENES, D-A-E-N-E-S. And yes, there's more than 50,000 adverse events reported there. But that does not mean that these are all linked to being vaccinated, because we cast an incredibly wide net and a fine net. We interview people after they've been vaccinated. We ask doctors to report. We, you know, scour what's going on at the hospitals. And everything gets thrown into this wide net, you know, with the fine mesh. And you find everything in there. You find painful erections. You find hair loss. So these are all things that have been reported in the days or weeks following the vaccine. It does not mean the vaccine caused these things. And then it becomes up to a team from the Therapeutic Goods Association. They specially constitute these teams like detectives to get in there. And, you know, when it's things that they can, you know, easily say, well, look, you know, this person, it's true, they died a week or so after having the vaccine, but look, they had stage 4 colon cancer, or this person died maybe 5 weeks after having the vaccine, but they, you know, had a history of heart attacks and they had another heart attack. Well, those things are not suspicious. It's the things that really stand out and are, that are above the background for that particular age group, or that they send these teams in to go in and investigate. And there are grey areas, as I talk about in the article. So as we know, there is the blood clotting condition, thrombosis with thrombocytopenia. Now, that's one of those conditions that sticks out like a sore thumb. Even though blood clotting disorders are common, 40 people a day in Australia have, well, you know, go into hospital because of a blood clotting problem. It's usually in older people, their platelet levels are normal, But in this was a very unusual type of clotting disorder, first picked up in the UK and linked to having the first dose of the Astra vaccine. It was stood out like a sore thumb because it was happening in younger people. It was happening in odd parts of the body, like in the brain or in the intestine. And as they dug into it more, it was very clearly a problem with the immune system rather than a problem with your clotting system. And they indeed picked up these unusual antibodies against platelet factor 4. But having said that, there are grey areas where these teams will go in there and they will, you know, look at the patient's medical history and teams of five or six specialists and really trying to drill down in each case. So I've waffled on a bit there, but I think having interviewed people at the TGA, having interviewed Christine McCartney, who's the head of this organisation for vaccine surveillance, it's become clear to me that the attitude they have is not let's cover this up, as my friend was, suggesting. Wow, is this a big cover up? Are they suggesting to us that, you know, for whatever reason, let's just not worry about these adverse effects and just get vaccinated? It's the exact opposite of that. The attitude is extreme vigilance. Let's look at everything here. Let's capture everything in our net. And then if there's anything suspicious, we go through it on this case-by-case basis.
Did you feel it your responsibility as a science journalist who had access to talking to these people in these high places? Did you feel a responsibility to address the concerns of your friend?
Yes, I did. I found that, in the year and a half or more that we've been living with COVID, my friends are often expecting me to be a source of authoritative information. So I've been called upon in this way a lot over the last year and a half. But it became very poignant over this last few weeks where we can see the bullet is headed our way. You know, the Delta is arriving, it's here. It's just a matter of time. There's no going back to zero with the Delta strain. I mean, at the beginning of this year, we were having, all of Australia was in a big donut. So, you could entertain the idea fancifully, I suppose. maybe this could continue, maybe. But and with the Alpha strain even, we were able to contain it. But there's no containing the Delta strain. And so it is coming our way. And I personally felt very alarmed for some of my friends, particularly my older friends, who are in this very high risk group. The risk for them, if they're, is well over 1%. So I felt, yes, I'm morally obligated to dig into the information, to address my friends' concerns and try to answer it as best as I can. So this one, the first person who got me off, I wasn't able to convince him, but two other friends I have managed to convince. And one of them is a girlfriend who, she was very concerned about having the Astra vaccine because she, one of her, in the past, her blood tests had showed that she was more inclined to clot, her cells were inclined to clot at slightly faster than normal. So I really encouraged her to find a GP who would really listen to her concerns and counsel her. And she had to shop around for GPs, but eventually she found a GP who sat with her for an hour and went through all the science with her on the clotting risks from the Astra vaccine and why she was not more at risk, because her clotting risk actually wasn't based on some sort of immune reaction. And she said she so enjoyed this session with him that he even gave her a test at the end, and she passed with flying colors. And then he gave her the vaccine, and he sat with her for half an hour, keeping her calm. It was such a lovely experience. Mm. So that's what she needed. I think she needed my prodding to validate that, you know, she had a right to get good information to address her anxieties, and then she found the GP who would do that for her.
And what about your other friend? You said that you'd also managed to convince.
My other friend is my singing teacher, and he's a wonderful singing teacher, and he's, you know, in his 70s. So he's at very, very high risk should he get infected, and he's in a high risk occupation with young people, people of all ages, breathing intensely over him. And, you know, one of his clients who is a doctor apparently had told him, oh, no, you definitely should not get the vaccine. It's too dangerous. And you should get ivermectin instead. So it took me several weeks of talking to my singing teacher. I can mention his name, Bill. Several weeks of talking to Bill and really realizing how difficult it was for him. I mean, how do you tell the difference, you know, when people with letters after their name are telling you one thing, doctors, and others are telling you. So he has me, his science student, versus this other guy, his doctor student. Who should he believe? So I just tried to, I think, address that issue by saying, Bill, you've got to follow the data here, that people with letters after their name get things wrong all the time, and we're seeing that big time at the moment. And as a science writer yourself, if you haven't already, you will see that most of the stories you do will involve scientists who vigorously disagree with each other. It's not new. And as a science writer, it's always a bit of a conundrum. Okay, what do I do with this? So you really have to go on a journey with each story, and the way I've found to deal with it is, well, I present the arguments of both sides, and, you know, maybe in the course of having worked on my story for a few weeks, I will come down stronger on one side than the other, but I'll explain why. Mm-hmm. And put that in front of my reader. In a way, it's like being a judge in front of a jury that has heard the evidence from the prosecution and the defense. But then as the judge, you have to help your jury weigh the evidence. What is the strength of the evidence on this side versus the strength on the other side? And that was the way I tried to explain it to Bill, that, look, the evidence for vaccines, you've got 5.7 billion data points. That's incredible. It's the biggest vaccine rollout ever in history. And what we know from the, you know, 200 years of the history of vaccines is that if we're going to see something nasty, we generally see it in the first few weeks when the immune system is getting all, you know, ramped up, and if there's going to be any collateral damage, we'll see it then. And so, you know, the early trials are now over a year old. The mass rollout has been going for 6 months. We have huge amounts of data to look at this, at the possible adverse effects of these vaccines. I mean, in Australia, we are incredibly lucky. I mean, we've let the rest of the world be our guinea pigs. So on the basis of that, I can tell you what the side effects are going to be from these vaccines. I cannot tell you either what the effectiveness is of ivermectin or what its side effects are if you use it every day as a prophylactic, or you use it at high doses, which is what you know, some people are recommending for the use of ivermectin. Mm-hmm. So I think it was that sort of argument that got Bill across the line.
You've been reporting on science for many years. Have you ever felt that it's more important to communicate science than at this moment?
No. It's kind of always been, what's the word, a boutique concern. I'm not sure that's the right word, but, you know, I've written a book about stem cells. You know, it was a big thing when I wrote it in 2005, you know, everybody was very worked up about the stem cell debate. Should we, you know, allow the destruction of surplus IVF embryos to make embryonic stem cells that could treat people with paralysis, for instance? You know, it was a big issue, but, you know, it wasn't in this moment. You know, next week, a life and death issue possibly for you, Lauren. Yes, it was possibly a life and death issue for people 20 years in the future. But no, I've never, I can't personally recall when I've felt I need to communicate this science now. And the concerns of my friends are real and I need to address this.
I'd like to come back again to your friend who started all of this off. And he said that you didn't end up convincing him, yeah, even though you laid out all of the facts and went on this big investigative journey. What do you think we should say or do to these people who we can't convince with facts? Do you think there's a way to reach them on a different level, an emotional level instead?
I think at this point it's quite reactive. He's very reactive, and people are complex. I've tried all my best, and I will still keep trying if I can, you know. So, for instance, this friend of mine has children and grandchildren. So, yesterday I listened to 5 pediatricians, most of them based at the Royal Children's Hospital, just so earnestly, you know, making their way through the data to try to find what is the best answer for our youngsters who are really too young to be vaccinated at the moment. We don't have the data to say whether children under the age of 12, whether it is at the moment safe to vaccinate them. And I sent it to him, hoping that he would listen to it, to hear what the voice of earnest pediatrician scientist sounds like, because unfortunately he's looking for his expertise down the rabbit hole of the internet. People with extremely aggressive voices making very confident claims about ivermectin, accusing these sorts of pediatricians of all being part of some conspiracy. And it's kind of absurd, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a struggle to reach those people, isn't it?
Yeah. And how do you argue? I mean, of course shit happens in the world. There are real conspiracies. And, you know, I mean, we had the Trump era. I would not have believed it if I hadn't lived through it. Yeah, so it's sort of changed my Pollyanna view of the world big time. But that doesn't mean everything is a conspiracy. You still have to use a mature tool set to work your way through weighing evidence.
Well, I hope that the articles that you've written and the journey that you've been on with the facts has helped to give some people the toolkit to make those decisions. So thank you so much, Ella, for chatting to me today. I really appreciate it, and it's been really wonderful to hear about your journey.
Thanks, Lauren.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. Remember that you can head to cosmosmagazine.com via the link in the description for more great content, and specifically the very articles that Elizabeth Finkel was talking about today. You can also subscribe to Cosmos Magazine, Australia's only science print magazine, and Cosmos Weekly, with its access to our exclusive deep dive insights into the biggest issues. You can watch and listen to all our Cosmos briefings via the link that you'll also find in the description. And remember, if you support science and its communication, please support our work at the Royal Institution of Australia. I'm Chuck Smeaton. Today's interview was hosted by Lauren Fuge, and our executive producer is Catherine Roberts. Thank you